All right, welcome to class. Glad to have you with us. Let us start by looking at the quiz that was due an hour and a half ago. Many of the questions, the majority, a fairly strong majority, was getting right, but let's just talk about a few of the odds and ends here. We had these various questions about bugs of programs, and so we had in particular here a couple of claims about if for every program, test zero reporting the program implies test one reports the program having a bug, and there is some program that test one does that test zero does not report. Okay, that suggests that there is this strict superset behavior, right? All of the elements that are reported by T0 are also reported by T1, and some are not, hence the proper subset relationship. We were doing great when it came to knowing what the false positive rate should be. So just a handful of outliers, but basically we were there. Also doing pretty well when dealing with these entailments. The first two, we were great. We understood that for all entails exists. A little less good when it came to these other statements. Okay, so exists for all. Remember, this suggests that I can find something for which it is always true. That entails there is some, for everything I can look at, there is some value. In particular, whatever the x was that satisfied this expression will also satisfy each of these expressions. Remember, we need to sort of, if we think about these as loops, this outer for all is looping through all of the y's, and for each of them needs to find an x. If I found one x that works for everything, then I can always find that x for each of the things as well. So we have this entailment as a consequence. This other one does not work. It's simply the reverse of that, right? So if I know that for everything I can find something, that does not mean that I found the same something for all of them. So for example, it might be reasonable to say that everybody has a favorite food, but that does not imply there is some food that is everyone's favorite. And so we do not have this entailment, even though we do have the other entailment. If there was some food that was everyone's favorite, then everyone would have a favorite food. So that's question four. Feel free to ask questions in the chat. I realize there's a slight delay. I'll move forward, and if they show up, I will come back to them. So if I have this function that's defined over the domain z cross z plus, that means any integer is okay for x, but only positive integers are okay for y. And so if I have any integer over any positive integer, I end up with the rational numbers. Remember, this is almost the definition of the rational numbers. Or in particular, it's the definition of the fractions, which leads to the rational numbers. Note, because the numerator can be any sign and get the positive and negative, because the denot and when we come down to this next one, we are total. We are total because the only place this would not be defined is if y was zero, but we have said the domain of y was positive integers. Isn't z a subset of Q? Z is a subset of Q, but is also a subset of the codomain, right? The codomain needs to be large enough to contain all of the answers. And so, while it is true that z is a subset of Q, it is also true this function produces some values that are not in z. And so, while z is a subset, it doesn't work. It isn't a legal codomain. The codomain must be at least as large as all of the values that can be produced. We have this question about being injective. Okay. Remember, injective means any elements of the domain map, each element of the domain maps to a unique element of the codomain. There are never two elements of domain that map to the same thing. And that is not true here. For example, 1, 2 and 2, 4 map to the same rational number. And so this is not an injective function. It is, however, surjective because every fraction, every rational number can be represented by some such fraction. So we can reach everything, but we don't always reach it a unique way, which also implies that it's not invertible. All right. We have this other relation, which is supposed to be true if two values are coprime or relatively prime. Their greatest common divisor is 1. Okay. So we want to know, is this symmetric or anti-symmetric? The answer is it's symmetric, right? If X and Y are coprime, then Y or X are also coprime. It's a characteristic of how the GCD works. It doesn't care about the order. So it is symmetric. Is it reflexive or irreflexive? I might come back and revisit C. The case where you could say that C depends on which definition we pick for C. The one case where it looks like we might be reflexive is for the number 1. 1, 1. The greatest common divisor is 1, but are traditionally not referred to as coprime. And so I currently have it keyed only for one of those two things, but I should probably also include the other. So I will come back after class and mark C also as a correct answer. Most numbers, this is not reflexive, right? Almost any number you pick is not coprime with itself, right? The greatest common divisor of 7 and 7 is 7, not 1. But since 1, we didn't give you the domain here, and since 1 is potentially included, C might also be correct. All right, I will adjust that key after class. Is it transitive? No. So the fact that pairs of numbers are coprime does not imply that that connects, right? And so, for example, 2 and 3 are coprime, 3 and 4 are coprime, but 2 and 4 are not coprime. We had this just sort of look up what an equivalence relation in a partial order is, and we were doing great, except for this odd statement that partial orders needed to be reflexive. I don't know why most of you thought that was the case. Some partial orders are, some partial orders aren't. Therefore, it isn't a must. For example, less than is a partial order that is not reflexive. Less than or equals is a partial order that is reflexive. They're both partial orders. Antisymmetry and transitive are generally required. I weighed this so the answers A and B had lower weight than answers C, D, and E to try to reflect the fact that this was sort of a maybe, but we definitely don't require reflexivity in order to be a partial order. For this relation, I actually put some notes here that you can see to try to show what's going on, right? So we have this function 2 plus 3x. Is it symmetric, anti-symmetric, or neither? Okay, so remember the definition of anti-symmetry is that if you look at two distinct values, x not equal to y, and that are related, then the reverse relation is not related. And so what we can do here is we can consider what this would look like if they were related, if it was symmetric, right? So this would be y equals 2x plus 3, and the symmetric version of that would be x equals 2 plus 3y. If you solve this system of equations, there is only one solution, where x and y both equal negative 1. And that, therefore, would be outside the domain of this definition of antisymmetry. Therefore, we know that for all other pairs of numbers you pick, we have the antisymmetric behavior. So we do indeed have antisymmetry here. Reflexivity, we were really having some trouble with this. Note that 0, 0 is not related, which means we're not reflective. But negative one is related, so we're not irreflexive. So neither is the correct answer here. There are cases where we are neither reflexive nor irreflexive. And is it transitive? It is not, right? And again, we can just take arbitrary examples. So 0, 2 and 0 are related, 2 and 8 are related, but 0, 8 are not related, so it is not transitive. Could I explain question 15? I just picked an arbitrary pair that wasn't related. That's not difficult to do, right? I can pick almost any x and compute its corresponding y. And if I don't get that same number, then I'm not related, right? So reflexivity, I'm looking at ones that are the pair, right? If it's reflexive, every pair that is the same number twice would be related. And here is an example that is not related. You can actually pick any number other than negative 1. 2, 2 is not related, 100, 100 is not related, etc. I just picked one. There is one pair, however, of the same number twice that is related. How did I find this? I just looked to solve the equation. X equals 2 plus 3x, right? I knew that this was related if this expression held, and reflexive means both sides need to be the same. So I just said x equals 2 plus 3x to find negative 1. Yes, I did talk about that, and we'll be adding that to the key as an alternative. The question is about 1 and 1. Again, they're traditionally not considered co-prime, although they do have a Grierson common divisor 1, and so there's some ambiguity there in the definition of co-prime, which I should key both of and forgot to do. I will add that after class. Any other questions about the quiz? Okay. Let me then go look at our schedule here a bit. Has the cumulative been updated yet? I have not added in online quiz 10 to the cumulative scores. No. I will do that probably later today, although I have a surprisingly busy day, so it might not be till tomorrow. Okay. How is a partial order different from a total order? A partial order is allowed to have pairs of values that it doesn't tell you whether they're related or not. Whereas a total order, given any two values, it must tell us which one is greater than or less than the other, potentially excluding reflexive items. So a total order like this, then you can pick any pair of numbers and either x is less than y or y is less than x, unless they're the same. So any distinct pair. A partial order doesn't have to have that property. It can have pairs that it doesn't relate one way or the other that aren't the same. So for example, if I think about the length of strings, if I said that, a shorter string, that could still work. I am sorry that Wikipedia said partial orders are reflexive. That is not the traditional definition. So, sorry. Our textbook didn't say that. Our class didn't say that. So why is the first question a proper subset and not just a subset? Yep, it's a proper subset because there exists some element that's in the set that is reported by T1 that is not in the set reported by T0, ergo proper. Does the codomain have to be a superset of the range? Yes, but it doesn't have to be a proper superset. Isn't something defined by the function writer? So in code, yeah. So when we define a function, I define the codomain. But it will be a superset of the range by definition, right? Like that's, if I were to say my codomain is smaller than my range, then what I'm actually saying is the formula I have given you doesn't always return an answer, right? And so when I look at something like this, where I say this function is defined over this domain, all the values that can be produced are produced. If I were to say, and restricted to the codomain of integers, for example, then I would be telling you that this function is undefined for a lot of information, but that wasn't provided in this case. Incidentally, if I did define a smaller codomain, I would also have changed the definition of the range to be the subset, the intersection of what could be produced by the formula and what is accepted by the codomain. Anything else about the quiz? Okay, let's talk a little about where we are, and I've got a question to ask about April 24th as well. So this week we're going to talk about logarithms. Logarithms are not a discrete math topic, but they are a topic that we found that some of you have not learned in high school and are needed in subsequent courses. So these are part of continuous math that is needed and not all of you have been taught. So we'll be talking about those this week, and we'll have a lab on them on Friday, a lab and quiz on them on Friday. Next week, we're going to talk about a topic that is discrete math, or discrete structures, is in scope, but is commonly not reached by the end of a course. And so in some sense, it's sort of a little bit of an enrichment, something that you will definitely find useful in subsequent courses, something we're discussing, whether we want to add to the requirement for versions of this course in the future or not, currently as a faculty. So my tentative plan was to not test on that, to teach it to you as an enrichment. And then we would just have in-class quiz 12, which would be an opportunity to make up previous in-class quizzes. And then the final exam, which would also be an opportunity to make up previous quizzes. As an alternative, I could have, as in-class quiz 12, I could have a quiz that measures, can you do some proofs based on the state machine information we did, and have another in-class quiz on proofs. I am comfortable either way there. I will come back to the question in chat, sorry. I'm comfortable either having one more proof quiz or not having one more proof quiz. And so I would just like your opinions. If you can use the yes and no options in the participant lists of the Zoom session. Yes, if you would like to have another proofs quiz on April 24th. No, if you would rather not have such another in-class proof quiz on April 24th. Unsurprisingly, I'm mostly seeing no's. I did want to check that out. The yes and no should show up in the participant list. Underneath the list of participants, there should be various icons, including yes and no. It looks like the no's have it in sort of an overwhelmingly. We have maybe three or four yeses. So barring any changes, and it's possible that after you get back in class quiz 11, which will also have some proofing in it, that probably also have some proving in it. We'll see exactly how that works out, you'll have a different opinion. But for now, we will plan, therefore, to use the schedule as written for now. Would it have only proofs? It would have only proofs. They would be proofs about state machines, but it would have only proofs if we were to have it. All right. Then I did have a question about the domain for 6 is the Cartesian product of all integers and positive integers. That is correct. Yes. All integers for x, all positive integers for y. Okay, so we're going to dive into proofs. Some of you will have already learned everything we will say about proofs earlier in your life. Some of you won't. There appears to be a trend in high schools toward doing less about proofs, about logs rather, in your high school experience. So I have two things that I want to look at briefly. First is the definition coming from Wikipedia that talks about this idea that it being the inverse of exponentiation. And that is probably useful to know. You'll note actually this very first paragraph comments that that this is commonly used in something called big O notation, used in algorithm analysis. You may or may not have already had a class that starts introducing this. Logs are extremely important in computing. And there's a lot of sort of general information and a lot of examples in Wikipedia that if you're new to this, completely new, haven't seen them before, I think you will find useful. My surveys of students in previous semesters show that most of them have seen logs, know that the log function exists and its general concept, but haven't seen all the information that we need you to know. And so I also have this write-up about the things you should know, including beginning a summary on logs. On logs, we'll cover numbers, and we'll also have some proofs to answer the question there in the chat. We'll probably also have some proofs. There are interesting proofs to be done with logs. Whether we'll have space for them will depend partly on how quickly things go. All right, so we have various identities we need to understand about logs to sort of deal with what's going on. And then I have more definitions and examples here that's designed to really focus on that specific. Incidentally, I also have at the very end some other math that we've found some people don't know, but some faculty assume you already know. I believe we've already talked about these three at other times, but they're here just as an extra in case you're interested in. Rather than go through that write-up though, We're going to sort of try to do today a sort of an introduction to these concepts, try to derive some of these theorems. Wednesday, we will then show how they're used in various purposes and maybe run a couple of proofs. So this is how the plan is. So we are familiar with expressions like 2 to the 4th, right? Which means, by definition, 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, exponentiation. And so there is, and that is also equal to 16. And so if we take this as a function, right? If we think about the PAL function, most programming languages call this function in its functional writing PAL 2, 4. The question we want to ask is, what is the inverse of this function? And this function does have an inverse, assuming we define it for positive bases, for positive lower numbers. It is on 1 to 1, it is on 2, or if you prefer, injective and surjective, therefore bijective, if we define it only over the positives for the first argument, which suggests an inverse must exist. And so that inverse is called log. So PAL 2, 4 equals 16. And then we want to have some sort of inverse of this. But because we have two arguments, we have a sort of this number we are raising to a power and the power, we can only put one of them over here in our log. And for various reasons, the one we usually want is we want to leave the 2 here, and in programming, for whatever reason, we traditionally swap the order. Not always, but most programming languages will swap the order. And this will give us back the other direction. So the numbers we are going to be inverting are between this number and this number. The way we write this in math, because this 2 is sort of special, the traditional way of writing it is log 2, 16, often with parentheses, though not always. We call this the base. Okay, so log base 2 would be how we would read this, to figure out what this log is. Logs are really important in many areas of computing. A lot of algorithms that will have problems we want to solve, the best possible algorithm we have, will have some sort of log component in how it works. And part of the reason, not the full reason, but part of the reason we can think about is that this, the result of the log tells us something about a representation. When I think about a number like 31415, let's put a comma there, right? I have this number. There's two ways to think about its size. It is 5 digits. It is also about 30,000. Right, so we have these sort of number of digits versus total values that that number of digits could represent. And it turns out that the log base 10, because there are 10 digits, the log base 10 of a number is going to be approximately equal to the digits to write it. And this actually follows from some of the things we were doing earlier about counting, right? Count how many things you can make with 5 digits and you end up with 10 to the fifth. So log base 10 will give us back in that other direction to find out how many digits we need to write something. This, of course, so we have this ability to try to figure this out. Now, we define logs to be fully contiguous, not discrete in general. There is a thing called a discrete logarithm that's occasionally used in cryptography. But in general, we're going to use this continuous version of the logarithm that gives us a real number back. And so if we give it a number like 30,000, it isn't going to return 5, because there are bigger numbers that could be represented with 5 digits than that. It's also not going to give us 4, because it's more than 4 digits. So the log base 10 of 31415 is going to be somewhere between 4, bigger than 4 because it's more than 4 digits, and 5, less than 5 because it isn't the biggest number we could possibly represent with 5 digits. And there are various ways of computing this. You can learn about in some calculus classes and so on using infinite series or other ways of getting here. But this gives us sort of an intuitive understanding. It's not really restricted in any way to numbers. Any representation, in general, our representation of a value will have a log size of the magnitude of the value, however we decide to represent it. And so when we can make an algorithm that can work directly on the representation, we can make the difficulty of the task sort of have a log factor in how it works. So logs show up a great deal as we're dealing in computing and analyzing algorithms, making better ones, and so forth. So that's a little motivation. Let's start talking about things that are true of logs. All right. There's a handful of identities that we want just all the time when we're dealing with logs. Let's stick with log base 10 for now. Let's go to log base 2, make my example a little bit easier. All right. The log base 2 of 8 times 4. Well, 8 times 4 is 32, which is 2 to the 5th. And so I expect this to be 5. Note, though, that the log base 2 of 8 is 3, and the log base 2 of 4 is 2. And the sum of those two things is 5. Okay, which is the same number. And this generalizes for all numbers we might care to pick. Okay. The log base, any base of any two numbers being multiplied together is equal to the sum of the log in that base of those two things. This equation is another reason we love this in computing, because multiplication is non-linear and messy to reason about, but addition is clean and linear and easy to reason about. And I can turn a multiplication problem into an addition problem by taking a log of the function, okay? And so this is not nearly as commonly the reason we will see it as the idea of representations, but it is also a valuable thing to understand, okay? So this identity is absolutely worth memorizing. You are going to see it again and again and again all through your time in computing. It is going to be used to discuss and solve many algorithms, their performance, their implementation throughout the entire space of computing in every subdiscipline of computing that I'm familiar with. This also makes some sense, right? If I were to have 2 to the 5th times 2 to the 3rd, that is equal to 2 to the 8th, right? We had in the other version of this, we had this idea that multiplication of powers causes the sum of the powers, right? So you've already sort of seen this as you've been learning about powers. And this is just the same equation written the other way, written with the inverse applied to it instead. So we have this notion. There's a few corollaries that follow from this that are probably also worth knowing just in their own right. Okay, let's consider the log base b of x to the n. Well, x to the n is defined to be x times x times x times and so on times x, where I have n of those x's. That's what we mean by power. And we just learned that those products can be turned into sums. So that's going to be a log base b of x plus a log base b of x plus a log base b of x out for n of those logs. And that's the definition of multiplication. So that's just n log base b of x. If we take the sort of beginning and ending, let me just copy down the right left-hand side of what where we started here, down over here, log base b of x to the n is equal to n times the log base b of x. This is another identity that's going to be show up so often, it's probably worth memorizing. It turns out that we can take powers and turn them into multiplication when we take the log. Right? If additions are easier than multiplications, multiplications are much easier than powers. And so this can also be used to simplify problems, to reduce their complexity in various ways. It'll also be used as a way of showing that certain tasks don't matter in the how complex they are. Right? So as you learn about an algorithm analysis and asymptotic analysis, it's going to turn out that if we can make this a constant, then it's not going to matter in a log when it would in something else. You'll get to learn more about that with orders of complexity, okay? But this follows directly from this other principle, that just because of what it means to take a power. Another one that follows directly from this principle, the log of x over y. Well, that is defined to be simply x over y just means x times y to the negative one power. Okay, and combining all of the things we already know, that means we have the log of x plus minus one times the log of y. And we usually say plus minus one times as just minus. And so division turns into subtraction. Is another corollary of the statement we've already had. So these allow us to sort of take more complicated arithmetic inside of a log function and make it less complicated outside, or equivalently, to take math that's outside of a log and push it inside using these equations. So these are some key log identities we will often want to know as we're dealing with our logarithms. This does suggest some odds and ends, okay? If we go back to meaning how many digits, if I think about digits is going to be log base 10, then the digits needed for a 10-digit number plus a 10-digit number, times a 10-digit number. Let's do that, okay, times a 10-digit number. If I want to multiply two 10-digit numbers, well, that means I need to know the log base 10 of two 10-digit numbers multiplied together, right? So I have essentially 2 to the 10th times 10 to the 10th. And that is just going to tell me, I work through this math, that's going to be the same as the sum of those two logs. That's going to be 10 plus 10, which is going to be 20, right? And so we can see that multiplying numbers, I can figure out how big the result could be using these logs. This can be useful to find out if I have enough space. Am I able to do the math I need in the space I have allocated to me? We can, so we have these various things, applications of these three identities that we can use beyond just simplifying math to try to answer basic questions about what we might want to do. All right. The other main identity that we're going to deal with in computing, in addition to our summation, power, and difference or ratio identities here. The other main identity we're going to want to do is called the change of basis. And this comes up very often when we're changing representations. For example, inside a computer, we often store binary numbers. Okay, so for example, by far the most common way of storing non-integer numbers inside a computer has 53 significant bits. This would be the double data type in Java. This would be the float data type in Python. It would also be the double data type in C and C++. Okay, and it is implemented in such a way that it stores 53 bits of information plus some information about where the place value is. This is how that number is stored. And I want to know how I can represent this. How many digits do I need to represent this as a base 10 number to show it to the user? How many digits should I show them? And so to figure out this, okay, we can sort of, we'll go the long way and then we'll come back to the short way. This means our number could be as big as 2 to the 53rd. We sort of have 2 to the 53rd levels of information that we could have. And we want to end up taking the log base 10 of 2 to the 53rd, which should be equal to 53 times the log base 10 of 2 using our power rule. But that means I actually have to compute log base 10 of 2, okay? Which I can do, but it's a little bit annoying. So I would probably like to be able to sort of translate directly between these different bases, figure out what's going on. And so we have this special change of basis formula. The log base b of x is going to be, for any a I might pick, the log base a of x divided by the log base a of b. This is the change of basis formula. So I have a question about where did 2 to the 53 come from? That is all of the possible strings of bits I can represent, as was also noted in the chat. Thanks. Okay, this is my general formula. And we can actually see how this works to some degree using this, along with one other little tweak that we're going to see along the way, right? So if I think about this equation here, we want to rewrite it as a log base 10. So if we wanted to rewrite it as a log base 2, what we could do here is we say, okay, we've got, I'm doing this backwards. Where are my notes here? Yes, okay. So let's suppose I know that 53 is the log base 2 of my number, right? That's how many bits I need to represent my number. And I want to know how many things is equal to the log base 10 of that number. We're going to end up getting the same value, okay? We're going to get that same value by changing basis. So I'm going to, let's call this y. Is an unknown. I'm trying to find out that y value. So I know that y equals log base 10 of x. I want to change that into log base 2 because I know what log base 2 is. So I'm going to take this log base 10 of x and I'm going to rewrite it as the log base 2 of x divided by the log base 2 of 10. I know what the log base 2 of x is, so that's going to be 53 divided by the log base 2 of 10. And so I have this change of basis formula. Note now I have two different answers. I have 53 times log base 10 of 2 and 53 divided by the log base 2 of 10. These are also equal. I have two different ways of finding the same value, which suggests a corollary that I've seen used relatively rarely. The log base a of b is equal to 1 over the log base b of a. Okay, so if you swap the order of the two things, you find the inverse of the number, right? If it takes 3 bits to represent something, to represent one digit, then it takes 1/3 of a digit to represent one bit. Works back and forth. How did I get 53 equals log base 2 of x? I used this math here. This was my sequence here to get there. Oh, no, wait. Log 53 equals log base 2 of x. I don't have that anywhere, do I? Oh, I see. You're asking about this one right here. Where did this come from? This came from the fact that I have 53 significant bits. So I have 53 and they are bits. So log base 2 of x is the number of bits needed to represent x. x equals 2 to the 53. Yes. The set of all possible values I could get. I feel like this example did not go as smoothly as I had hoped it would. I am sorry. I may try again. Before I move on to try again, let me finish off at least what I've done for the people that are following, and then we'll try again. Oh, right. So I made these equal, and so I have this other corollary here, a fifth identity, giving us five identities: the sum, the power, the difference, the change of base, and the much less used, probably not worth memorizing, but maybe, ability to swap back and forth between bases when we take an inverse. Okay. You know what? Maybe as our way of going over this again, let's look at my write-up. Okay. So my write-up, I've tried to show some actual numbers to explore these same ideas. So we have what the definition of it is, some examples of that, this idea of it being number base 10 is the number of digits needed, and some actual examples, log base 10 of 81 is 1.9, et cetera. Okay. A little bit of conversation about how we can get to 2 in our log base 10, what the log base 2 is. A couple of special notations that are worth noting that I didn't mention earlier. The ln means log base e, where e is Napier's constant or Euler's number, this big number here. Why e in particular is special comes out of calculus, and you have or will get to see that as you take those classes. Not very commonly used in computing, occasionally. Lug with no O means log base 2. This is the one we use by far the most in computing because we tend to use bits a lot. And then in engineering, we tend to use digits, and so log base 10 is the most common. So if you see a log with no base, you don't know which of these it means. It might mean any of those depending on who wrote it. In computing, we will generally only write log with no base if the base doesn't matter. And we may talk a little bit about that here in a moment. Okay. Change of basis. So the example I used here in the write-up, which I had second thoughts about as I was preparing lecture today and maybe shouldn't have, is this idea about the difference between log base 3 versus log base 9. Okay, so if we think about log base 3 of 81, it's 4, because 3 to the 4th is 81. But 3 to the 4th is also 3 squared squared, or 9 squared, so the log base 9 is 2. And that actually didn't matter that I had 9 as opposed to some other number. In general, changing from log base 3 to log base 9 is the same thing as dividing by 2. Okay, and so the general formula for that, how did I know it was dividing by 2? I knew it was dividing by 2 because the log of base 3 of 9 was 2. Okay, and so we have this general formula where if I know it in one base, the value in another base is equal to the log in that base divided by that sort of difference form. So we've also got some examples with writing digits, right? We think about base 1,000, that's sort of what we're doing with commas to separate thousands when you write numbers. Technically, these are called millial numbers with digits written by 3 characters. And so for every 3 characters, I create one smaller digit, so I'm going to expect 1/3 as many of those 1,000 values needed as I had for those 10 values. I'm not sure any of these really make sense to most people offhand, but this is how this works. One of the key things to understand here is that this number, this AB number here, that's just a constant. For any given change of base, I'm just multiplying or dividing by a constant. And so pick any number of digits you want. It's going to take 3.3219, et cetera, more bits, that factor more bits to represent that number. Right? So give me a 10-digit number and I need 33.2 bits. Give me a 50-digit number and I'm going to need 150, 165, 166 bits, whatever that turns out to be. And I can just multiply by this number to do that conversion. And I have a further example here. If the 53 digits of bits of precision turns out to be 15.9 bits, digits of precision, just by finding that log base 2 of 10 factor. The logs of multiples, we already talked about here, this idea that when I multiply some numbers, I can work it through. So I have my x times y equals the sum of the logs. And I also have this corollary here that log base a of b to the n and so forth, the two corollaries we already talked about. And I think I talked about that very much the same as how I did in class or in my previous passage. So these are the things, these are the log identities. These are the things you need to know. And I have them summarized up here for you as the things you should be memorizing, studying, understanding. I guess we did actually skip this one. That's probably worth noting. Because the definition of log is the inverse of exponent, if I take the exponent of a log, I get back where I started. Also, if I take the log of an exponent, I get back where I started. So there is that that should also be known. Okay. Thoughts, comments, questions in the change of basis we did earlier. What was the A in the formula? I don't know which earlier you meant. I did several change of bases. We've already answered what topic. It'll be numbers. 2. Okay, maybe we're talking about here? This change of basis? So in this change of basis, right, my A was 10 and my B was 2, the way I wrote it here. I think I may have written it on this page the other way around. I may have swapped A and B. Yeah, I have B's and A's. I mean, they're just variables. You can pick either one you want. But yeah, I pick the one I have and change it into the one I want. To help in memorizing this, right, we have on one side, we have only one base. On the other side, we have only the other base. If that helps at all. Did I answer the question? Or is there more that you wanted me to know? Okay. Any other questions about the things we've discussed so far? All right. In my last 3 minutes, let's just talk a little bit about, we probably won't finish, we'll probably finish this off on Wednesday. When we have logs, most log expressions we could think to write will turn out to be irrational, not rational numbers. And I think sort of working through how we might prove this can help us use some log identities and can help us do some proof. And so we're going to spend a little bit of time on Wednesday walking through perhaps a few of these proofs, but let me just sort of remind ourselves of some proofing things we're going to want to use. We have several proof strategies that we could use at this point. We could use induction, we could use contradiction, we could use direct proof either by equivalence or entailment. And all of these in theory could work. We could do proof by cases as well. But when we're proving that something is not, we're trying to prove this vast set does not contain one element. The most natural approach would be proof by contradiction. Okay? Trying to show that this number isn't in the set is tricky. But if I assume it's in the set and then derive a contradiction, I'm going to be in a much better case. So we'll typically go by contradiction anytime we're trying to prove that something isn't an element of a set or some universal theorem doesn't hold. Okay. And this really is a universal theorem. What we're really saying is for all Q in Q, it is the case that Q is not equal to the log base 2 of 3. Right? That's what not equals means. And so to prove a universally quantified thing to be false, we commonly do contradiction. to show that there is, we assume there is some element. Okay, so we need to assume an element Q of Q such that Q equals log base 2 of 3. And we will pick up with how we go from there, as well as with any questions you have about log identities in class on Wednesday. I will also post some practice problems with log identities and proofs for you to review for the quiz this week. I thank you all for your time.